Healthcare, Subcommittee on Health Policy. Today is January 30th, 2007. I have just a couple comments as we open. We have some invited testimony. This is an informational meeting today. It is a review of healthcare workforce issues. And what we would like people to focus on today as they're here with their testimony is helping us as a committee, as a subcommittee, with information that can help us as we go forward making policy choices in the healthcare field. So our first person here is Dr. David Goldberg, Executive Director, Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Amici and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here before you today. I'd like to share with you quickly just a little bit about the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute, because it's a new creature since the last legislature, and you may not have heard about it. It was an outgrowth of the Governor's Healthcare Workforce Task Force, and it is attempting to build on the work, the very fine work of the Oregon Nurse Leadership Council, the Oregon Nurses Association, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Healthcare Systems, OHSU, the Office of Rural Health, and all of the efforts that have gone into looking at health workforce issues. We're here to provide subject matter expertise to the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and we're broadly representative of labor, industry, and government. Our board looks like a who's who and healthcare across the state in terms of private, public, and the educational community as well. So we're attempting to bridge industry and the needs that are being seen out in the field with the educational programs that are being provided at both public and private institutions. We're getting direct support from the Community College and Workforce Development Division, as well as contributions by Providence and Kaiser, and again the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Healthcare, the Oregon Employment Department, Department of Human Services, and the Workforce Investment Board. Our approach will really be to focus on research, to look at best practices both in the state and outside of the state, to stimulate discussion between the industry where the needs are being felt and the educational programs where hopefully the needs can be met, and to bridge those kind of gaps, and to facilitate what is at sometimes interesting solutions among diverse stakeholders. So what's the context? You know, we've got a growing the perfect storm here. Oregon is blessed with a future that looks like the population is going to be increasing. It is also going to be aging, and in about 10 years, Oregon will be the oldest state in the nation in terms of percentage of population over age 65. That comes with some consequences. It certainly mitigates for an increase in demand of the healthcare system, because one thing we know very clearly is that as folks age, they demand more healthcare. And that is something that is hard to get around. At the same time, the healthcare workforce in the state is aging very similarly, and that the baby boomer generation populate most of the health professions in the state. And how they leave the workforce is going to be an interesting question. And doing decent succession planning, and this is not unique to healthcare, but it is sort of the double whammy in a sense, because we've got increased population, aging population, and an aging workforce, which makes the gap between what can be provided by the workforce and the needs of the population increasingly widening. The Oregon Employment Department projects 59,000 new workers needed between now and 2014. I've done an analysis of that, of their work, and I think that it's an underestimation for a variety of reasons. I don't think it's projecting some new industries that are growing around healthcare, new technology, health informatics, for example. I also think it's not taking into account the fact that as much as a third of our population has limited access now to primary care. And I know that the whole access debate that's taking place here in the legislature is very exciting and very important. But as we enfranchise more people into the healthcare system, it's going to put added demands that we have just not seen. It'll put demands in different places, which I think are important. We know there are significant shortages in nursing, and although we are in a bit of a hiatus, and you're going to be hearing from the nursing folks, I guess, on Thursday, and so I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, that at the moment new graduates are plentiful. But that is a temporary, very short-term phenomenon, and we're finding dramatic shortages in specialty nursing, particularly in critical care nursing, in operating room nursing, in emergency department nursing, in public health nursing, and in psychiatric nursing. And on the psychiatric front, to give you a notion of the scale of this challenge, the state hospital in its plans to replace itself with probably the current plan shows two large inpatient facilities in different parts of the state. They are projecting a need for up to 400 psychiatric registered nurses. And with no, I see Representative Greenlick smiling, and it was my reaction at the same exact moment. I said, "You're out of your minds. Where do you think these folks are going to come from?" And so we have, and this is an organization that's presently spending over $300,000 a month on agency nurses in order to just staff what they're doing right now. So there's some very dramatic issues that are facing there. The scale of the workforce challenge is also enormous. This is not unique to Oregon. I mean, if it were, we might be able to have some quick fixes, but this is an American phenomenon, and frankly, it's a Western world phenomenon. The Japanese are facing a similar thing. I've worked in various parts of the world, and this baby boom generation is affecting them just as it's affecting us, and so taking from another state or another country is not the answer either, because they're short as well. We also have some particular shortages, and you'll hear much more about this from the speakers that will follow me. Our rural areas are in trouble. I was director of rural health for the state of New Mexico for a number of years, 20 years ago, and frankly, the same exact issues that faced me there are facing our Office of Rural Health and the issues here today. Healthcare is one of the economic backbones of rural communities, and what brought me, frankly, to Oregon originally was coming to Reedsport with a grant to set up a rural health clinic there and a system that still exists today 25 years later. And I know how critically important that is in the economic well-being, let alone the healthcare access well-being of that community. Our public health system is in disarray. You know, we are coming out of 6 years of defunding the public sector. I don't need to tell you that the governor's budget that is being presented, that has been presented, really brings us back to 1999 numbers. And having been at Portland Community College for the last 6 years before taking on this position, I know that this was not a time when educators were sticking their heads above their cubicles saying, "Oh, what new programs can we start?" And this was a time when we were trying to protect the layoff of faculty and the closing of programs. And so as I looked at our state in preparing for the work plan for the Institute, it was clear that our public health system is terribly understaffed and underpaid. I mean, there's a pay differential that is creating really difficulties. Our emergency medical system, particularly in rural areas, has major gaps. Our school health system basically went away, except in a couple of districts over this period of time. We have a real need for a database for really understanding where our deployed healthcare system is. Where are the professionals? We know, for example, that there are licensed physicians. We know their names. We know their age. We know where they reside. But we really don't know, are they working as physicians? And if they are, do they take OHP members? Are they taking Medicare members? You know, one of the startling things of traveling around the state looking at the issues that are facing our communities in a place like Bend, if you are of Medicare age, you're going to have a very difficult time finding a primary care physician because people are not only aren't they there, but they're not taking Medicare. So there are some real challenges there. The Oregon legislature is really grappling with the issue of increasing access, and I think that is the critical healthcare issue that we face. And whether that's going to take a revolutionary change in the system, as many believe, or some tinkering in order to get more Oregonians covered by insurance and getting access, this is all going to have implications for workforce. The governor has targeted $28.4 million specifically on healthcare workforce in his educational budget. And I just want to give you a sense of sort of where this rubber hits the road, because I think it's important. One, if funded, it will generate 177 new nurses per year. 20 new nurse faculty members per year, which is a major shortage in the state. It's a real challenge. 42 clinical laboratory technologists per year, 24 dental hygienists, 14 to 20 ultrasonographers per year, 60 physicians, and 25 dentists. And you'll hear much more detail about those with subsequent testimony. In spite of the significant losses, we are beginning to track, and I've got a staff member working on this right now, the incredible generosity of the public of the private sector that has made up for a lot of the shortcomings that the public sector has had due to the recession of the last 6 years. And there are local hospitals that are paying for full-time faculty members on nursing faculties and community colleges. There is $26 million committed by the Providence system to the University of Portland to more than double, almost triple their nursing program. Well, we're seeing this in almost every community that the private sector has stepped up to try to shore up what was literally a sagging educational system that could not expand because the resources weren't there. With that, I'd like to conclude my testimony and just say that when we have the report of the private investments, I'll be happy to get that to you. It should be in the next month or so. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Representative Greenick.
Thank you very much. David, thank you for coming. I'm going to, if I might, Madam Chair, tell a little story about two little stories and then ask a question. And I'll have the same question for two gentlemen named Scott in the back who are going to be testifying. In 1967, I started the Home Health Agency, and it was when Medicare was just kicking off, and there was something in Medicare called a home health aide, but nobody knew what a home health aide was. So we decided we'll invent what a home health aide is, and we created a home health aide that could do about 75% of the physical therapy work in the home, about 50% of the social work, and about 40% of the nursing work in the home. There was one person, and we could train these people in 3 or 4 months, supervise them to begin to do things like that. So we had one person in the home doing physical therapy if that was needed, which was, you know, mostly taking a can of tomato soup and doing a range of motion exercise. And they could do social work, and they could do nursing services like Foley catheters and a variety of things, and we basically taught them to do that. Pretty soon the physical therapist came in and said, oh, what you guys are doing, you're doing physical therapy, but you're not a physical therapist and you're not a physical therapist aide, so you need to stop doing that. Well, are they doing it bad or anything? No, they're not, but they're not physical therapists and they're not physical therapist aides. And then the social workers came in and said, well, wait a minute, they're doing social work. Yeah, is it a problem? I mean, are they doing something wrong? They're being supervised. Well, it's not that they're doing anything wrong, it's that they're not social workers. And then, of course, the nurses were there pretty soon, and that's where the physical therapy assistant laws came about and all sorts of things. And those people were essentially relegated to an ash can. 3 weeks ago, I was in the Oregon Rehabilitation Unit, and one day, physical therapists would come in and do something, and then the next day, an occupational therapist would come in and do the same thing. And finally, after watching this happen, I said to him, well, what's the difference between physical therapists? Well, physical therapy does physical therapy, and we do occupational therapy. I said, yeah, but yesterday they did exactly the same thing. You know, but when the occupational therapist said it was occupational therapy, and when the physical therapist said it was physical therapy, and when I, you know, push on a little more, they would say, well, occupational therapists deal with small muscle, and physical therapists deal with big muscles, and that's the difference. I said, well, yeah, but they were both working with big muscles. Neither were working with small muscles. And then, you know, maybe occupational therapists do it above the waist and physical therapists do it below the waist. Yeah, but I don't have any above the waist problem. I have all below the waist problems. The point of these two stories is that when you mentioned some very interesting things, clinical specialists, sonographers, I mean, if you're in John Day, you are not going to have a physical therapist, an occupational therapist, and a phlebotomist and a sonographer and all those things. I mean, can't we start figuring out some way to get some people who can do these things in places where we know we are never going to get all these certified professions doing those things? Is there anything your institute's interested in working on?
Well, Vice Chair Representative Greenlick, there's there's a number of things that are going on. There's two trends happening, and you're very aware of this. One, there's a move toward super professionalism, and so the pharmacists are becoming doctors, and the physical therapists are getting doctors, and the nurse practitioners are becoming doctors now. And there is that professionalism, and that's being driven by the profession. And frankly, I don't think there's any way to really stop that, because I think that's just the progression of professions. However, when we look at in Oregon, there's two things that I think are very interesting. One is most of the long-term care in Oregon is provided at home, and it's provided by home health care workers who are neither social workers nor nurses nor even CNAs. So there are these generalists that are very similar to the home health people that you were talking about in 67 that are providing the bulk of long-term care in Oregon's homes. And I think watching what happens with them, they are at this point unlicensed. Secondly, I'm working on something that I think you're aware of as well with Dr. Kohler up at OHSU, where we're attempting to use technology in the form of a very high-powered computer decision-making system that will equip medical assistants, not nurses, medical assistants, to do primary care intake and triage with the assistance of this device. It's being pilot tested right now. We want to do a 5,000-person test to see if we can extend the workforce to be able to do primary care at the top of one's license and ability to do that in the context of a primary care team. I think that's exactly what we need to look at. And in terms of policy, I think anything that we can do to incentivize people to stay, to go to those rural areas or to stay in those rural areas or to be trained up who, when they're already working in those areas and have family and other commitments there, that's the answer, I think, to dealing with the alphabet soup of professionals that we lack in some of our rural areas.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome, Representative. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you for your excellent testimony.
Thank you.
Next, we have President Joe Robertson from Oregon Health and Sciences University Workforces Initiative. Dr. Robertson, thank you.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. I'm Joe Robertson, the new president of OHSU, and I'm delighted to be here. I've been told that I have limited time, so I will try and check in at the beginning to see that I have my assignment correct. As I understand it, I am supposed to talk to about workforce matters, and that is my intent. And I had the opportunity to speak to Representative Kotek, and she asked for some specific information as it relates to graduate medical education and also to pediatric dentistry, so I brought along some comments in that arena. I take it I understood my assignment.
Okay. Or we could say no, wrong committee.
From the Oregon perspective, the situation that we face here with regard to healthcare workforce is the same that we face across the country, only it's actually a bit worse. The situation's a bit more dire. I think across the nation we face a great impending shortage of healthcare providers, and the driving factor behind this is the aging demographics of our population. The population has grown more rapidly than the experts predicted, and the segment of the population that is growing most rapidly is the elderly. And the elderly, depending upon how you classify that, and I speak with all of us, I think that's becoming more sensitive every day. So if you just compare the utilization rates between 65 and 75, they're five times what they were at 35, and at 75 to 85, they're up to seven times. So we have an increasing population that is aging, that's using more resources. The good news is there are also more therapies available. Okay, when I started my career as an ophthalmologist, there were no treatments for macular degeneration. Now there are many. They're not always successful, but the situation is vastly improved. This is a condition that affects 25% of patients over 75 years of age. You know, there's a whole sub-workforce here that we need to train just to deal with that specific entity. The other, another compounding factor is the fact that the demographics of our workforce exactly reflect those of the population. If you look at the average age of our physicians, our nurses, or our other healthcare professionals, they're aging just as rapidly as the population. In the past 10 years, if you look at the average decade of the average physician age in Oregon, it shifted one decade to the right. The average age of a doctorate-trained nursing faculty is now in the about 57. There are hospital staffs in this state where the average age of the physician staff is also 57 years of age. And then finally, the last variable in this perfect storm is that our graduates, while perhaps better rounded and having a better perspective on life than some of us that trained earlier, will work fewer units during the course of their career. On average, they start later, they may retire sooner, and they have other interests and competing interests during the course of their career. So if you look in most of the calculations, we think that you should probably pick a 0.7 of what the fact of the work units, or like we used to say, relative value units of what historically has been the number. So now, in Oregon, the situation we face is a bit worse because, again, to look specifically at the physician population, we have, if you look at the number of medical students per capita, it is half the ratio across the nation. The American Association of Medical Colleges is predicting a 30% shortage, a 15 to 30% shortage of physicians by the year 2020. And therefore has called upon the medical schools to increase their numbers by 30%. This is not evenly distributed across all populations. Of course, the problem, I think, will be more severely felt in the rural communities. We all know that. But it is present everywhere. In Portland, 50% of internists no longer take any new Medicare patients. They are absolutely overwhelmed. Their practices are full, and they really don't have room, and at some point they have to start limiting, and they have maintained those patients that have been in their practice but have closed the door to new patients. The story that strikes very close to my heart that I tell is that my father-in-law has lived in Anchorage, Alaska for 20 years. He loves living in Anchorage, Alaska. He recently moved to Portland. The sole reason he moved to Portland was that there were not enough physicians in Anchorage, Alaska that he could get his medical needs adequately attended to. And he had lost a phenomenal amount of weight, had terrible problems, and basically he is alive today only because he moved to Portland, Oregon, where there were family resources that could be brought to bear to ensure that he could get medical care. Now, we have taken some very important steps. And OHSU has worked with many other health systems and other institutions to try and address this problem. We have increased the size of our classes. We have, I think some of you are probably quite familiar with the OCNI program in nursing, that is the collaborative that's working across institutions. It has been very successful increasing the number of new nursing students. We've done the same thing in medical education, where we've worked with Peace Health and the University of Oregon to establish a presence in Eugene, and next week we're looking forward to a public announcement about a memo of understanding that will have been signed between Oregon State University and Samaritan Health and OHSU to do the same thing in Corvallis. So we are trying to leverage our resources to work with whomever so that we can address this matter. We have done that in the face of a static budget, and the request, without going into detail, we feel that this issue is so important that the ask that were made by us out of the entire arena of possibilities were all focused on workforce. It was that important. So that's the stage in general. I think I would make a few comments in the areas where I've been requested to do so, and then throw it open to questions. Again, Representative Kotek asked me to make a few comments about graduate medical education and continuing medical education. After you finish medical school, then you normally go on to take an internship and residency. The residency is basically called graduate medical education, or GME. And on that, through the remainder of your career, you are involved in CME, or continuing medical education. Graduate, even if we are successful in increasing the number of medical students, and we address the bottleneck in that area, there will still be a constraint at the graduate medical education level. There is federal support for graduate medical education, but it is fixed at historical levels. At OHSU, we have 667 interns and residents. We have federal funding we have to self-fund 150 of those, and at roughly with salary and benefits of $65,000 apiece, and affiliated expenses that will often, in the hospital's cost accounting, approaches $100,000 a resident. So there is no extra institutional support for those that the institution has had to generate the funding to support those positions. So as you can see, there is a great demand, I think, throughout the state and by the departments to train more residents, but there is not financially the ability to do so. With regard to continuing medical education, this is really a new frontier. Continuing medical education sort of rested unchanged for the last probably 30 to 50 years. You know, you took some courses and you turned in your credits and everybody smiled, and that was continuing medical education. Well, the landscape is radically altered. The American Board of Medical Specialists has now implemented a plan that for the maintenance of your certification will require not only that you maintain your license, not only that you take CME, but that you actually take periodically that you retake an examination, and that you demonstrate ongoing self-evaluation and self-improvement in your practice. This is a formidable barrier. There is not a system out there that's in a comprehensive manner that is set up to provide, I think, the type of support and training that will be needed to carry this out. It's being implemented at different rates in each of the specialties, but that is a major issue looming out on the horizon.
Are you recertified?
Pardon?
Are you recertified?
I have not recertified. I was one of the last ones that was given, quote, lifetime certification, but I think even those of us with lifetime certification will be under pressure to be recertified. But I am improving my practice. The other issue, and we don't even know what we're going to call this yet, it is somewhere in the purview of GME and CME, is how we bring people back into the workforce after they've taken a sabbatical for whatever reason. There are many men and women that now leave the workforce and that after a period of time want to re-enter. Okay. If it's more than 2 years, you generally cannot gain privileges at the hospital where you were previously admitting patients and such. And there is no formal means of educating those people and then attesting to their competency. We have initiated a pilot program at OHSU, and we are doing that in selected cases, but it is very expensive because you have to take the time to evaluate, to not only train, but to evaluate these people. It usually takes 3 to 4 months, and we charge $5,000 to $10,000 a month to do so. But it's done on a pilot basis and hasn't been done in a widespread manner. But it has gained recognition. I think it's an area for significant future developments, and it could be tremendously important in addressing the numbers aspect of the workforce, because if you can keep someone in practice for an average of 3 years longer, it is the same as increasing your capacity by 10%. So I think this is an often overlooked aspect of the workforce agenda. And finally, with regard to the pediatric dental services, after a 10-year hiatus, the pediatric dentistry residency program at OHSU was reborn in 2005, thanks largely to a generous gift from the Reitman Foundation. This had been cut in 1994, and it was, like so many things, a result of Measure 5 budget cuts. It's currently a 2-year program, and there are currently 4 residents in each of the years for a total of 8 residents. The need is dramatic. The statistics are that I think that of the 70 pediatric dentists in the state, fewer than 20 of them have board certification, but yet there are only 70 total. There are overwhelming numbers with regard to the number of children out there and the need to be treated, and 24% having untreated dental decay. At the university, the number of pediatric visits has risen 44% just in 1 year, and we've significantly increased the number there, and I think this is a significant training program. The pediatric patients are now assured that they will be seen in a pediatric area by a pediatric dentist or a dental trainee with an attending dentist. So that's a very brief update. With that, I'll conclude my prepared remarks and answer any questions that the committee members would have.
Thank you, Dr. Robertson. Any questions for the doctor?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Robertson. Great to see you again. My question is just real basic. Are the issues that we face with trained medical personnel in Oregon, are they exclusively capacity issues, or are we also dealing at all with demand issues, i.e. demand to be trained in those various fields? I know it is a capacity issue, but is it exclusively a capacity issue?
At the current time, for all practical purposes, it's a capacity issue. If, however, we were to hit our targets with regard to the capacity, then there might be a demand. Let me explain. Again, using the medical school as a reference, since I was recently dean there and tend to still carry the figures around in my head. If you really look at the statistics and ask what size should the medical school be in Oregon, it should be somewhere between 200 and 250 students. Okay, it has been static since 1985, exactly the reflection of what's happened nationally. When we cross at somewhere around 200, there becomes a question of whether we have a sufficient number of adequately trained and prepared students in the pipeline that we could admit. Now, there are plenty of non-residents that would apply, but speaking to the opportunity for Oregonians to fill these slots. So that's part of the reason that we are, you know, this is a broad educational matter, and we are also very concerned about the pipeline.
Representative Gelser, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you. I represent Corvallis, and Oregon State University, and our community is very excited about the partnership that we're embarking on.
Thank you. We couldn't be more excited either.
I'd like to ask a question. I applaud the efforts to partner with both University of Oregon and Oregon State. And I wonder, and this is following up on Representative Bruin's demand issue, if there becomes a time when there's that demand issue, are you aware of or working on any programs to reach out to, for example, in the Beaverton School District, they have a medical magnet school at the high school level to get students at a younger age interested in the medical profession?
Yes, Vice Chair Bonamici, we could not be any more interested. We have initiated efforts. We bring several thousand students a year to OHSU to try and expose them to all the healthcare professions. It is very well shown that if you don't have kids hooked on science by the end of grade school or early into junior high, you have basically lost them. That is one of the reasons that I actually am proud to sit on the OMSI board to be part of the scientific outreach. It's the reason that OHSU is partnering with OMSI to bring Body Worlds to Portland, which will start June 7th and is this just incredible exhibit of plastinized anatomical specimens and whole human bodies that we think is going to energize and inspire a whole generation. We think literally hundreds of people will go through that exhibit. We also know with as it pertains to distribution in the pipeline, the more distributive we can be in not only who we accept but where we train, the more successful we will be in placing our students in diverse settings. That's one of the reasons that we make such an effort to support diversity in our recruitment programs. And with regard to the distribution, we think having places where students train spread throughout the state will also help the distribution. That's why all of our medical students, for instance, not the only reason, one of the reasons that they take a rotation in a rural setting. We know that if you are from a rural setting or you have a rural heritage, you are six times more likely to go and eventually practice in a rural setting. So we will do everything to partner with everyone we can to try and address that issue.
Thank you so much. Any other questions? Representative Greenlitz?
Yeah, just one. Now that you worked out a partnership with the University of Oregon and Oregon State, have you had any thought of partnering with Portland State?
We
Trick question. Watch out.
Well, I was down meeting with their senior administration just a couple weeks ago. We actually, I think, as you know, have a number of programs, and we're compiling the complete list. We are looking forward to the development of our Stitzer campus. That's 20 acres. For those of you that might not know the exact geography, that's 20 acres to the north of the current south waterfront. It's on the other side of the tram, up almost and abutting the Markham Bridge. And as we do that, I actually see that as a conduit of education and research between the two institutions. I look at that literally as a connector. So we talk about that very frequently. Yes.
Thank you very much for your excellent testimony and your work.
Okay.
Appreciate your being here.
Thank you very much.
And next up, we have Scott Ekblad from the Oregon Office of Rural Health.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Bonamici and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad, and I am the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health located at Oregon Health and Science University. I would like to talk to you for a bit today about the experience of the Office of Rural Health in dealing with workforce issues in rural communities. I think probably one of the most informative things that we do regarding the workforce is to help to recruit providers to rural communities. That's actually one of the things we're mandated to do by statute. That program's called HERO, or Healthcare Experts for Rural Oregon. It's been in operation since 1990. And I've personally been involved with that program since 1992, so I feel fairly comfortable talking about what our experience has been. First, let me give you a little bit of background on the Office of Rural Health. We are a statewide agency that began as part of the state government in 1979. There's a state Office of Rural Health in every state. We're one of the oldest ones in the country, I'm happy to say. We were relocated to Oregon Health and Science University in 1989, and we've been there since. So while no longer a state government agency, technically we're a state agency, statewide agency that's mandated by state statute to perform certain functions such as recruitment for rural communities. The Office of Rural Health is advised by the Rural Health Coordinating Council, a group defined in statute and appointed by the governor. It consists of rural representatives of 13 different professional organizations plus 5 consumer members. So that's a bit about the Office of Rural Health. I also want to add that during the last 6 months of 2005, our office and the Rural Health Coordinating Council conducted town hall meetings across the state. We made it to 7 different communities. I'm happy to say we had very good attendance. And if it's one thing I can share that's appropriate for this committee, it's that recruitment issues came up over and over and over again in every community that we went to. So. Perhaps the most startling evidence of the need for incentives to practice in rural areas is the distribution of physicians that we currently have in the state. And if you are looking at the testimony that I provided, the two graphs on the next page of my testimony shows the ratio of population to physicians in a couple different ways. And so in the first one, for example, you'll see that while frontier and rural, there is a greater percentage of the population compared to the percentage of physicians. In urban, it is the reverse. There's a greater percentage of the physicians reside in urban areas compared to the population. And then the one on the bottom, it's strictly a population-to-physician ratio. You can see frontier and rural are about the same. It's about 790 people for every physician, whereas in urban, it's 335 per physician. As of today, our recruitment service within the Office of Rural Health is working with 64 different rural practice sites to recruit healthcare practitioners for 135 openings. And that's strictly the people that contact our office requesting our assistance. So that by no means am I saying that that is every single opening that is available in rural Oregon. The following graphs illustrate the number and types of candidates we've worked with in the past, actually 2000 and the 2 years, excuse me, 2007 and the 2 years prior. Gives you a rough breakdown of the primary care physicians and usually nurse practitioners and PA candidates that we work with, and then the second graph is specialty care. There's one thing I want to point out. It is that in both graphs, the blue bar is foreign medical graduates, or J-1 visa physicians specifically, so a subset of foreign medical graduates. So when you're looking at the pool of candidates who want to practice in a rural area, I think this is an issue that's probably more prevalent in rural areas, is that there's an awful lot of J-1 visa physicians that are interested in practicing in rural communities compared to U.S. trained. On the next page, there's yet two more graphs, and that's to illustrate the referrals that we have made of the candidates in each of those years to our practice sites. And again, the first graph is primary care physicians and mid-level providers, and the second graph is specialty care referrals. Approximately 360 candidate referrals are made to rural Oregon practice sites in a given year, and still, this is a relatively high level of activity. We have one FTE in our office dedicated to recruiting for rural communities. Still, in the year since 2001, the rate of successful placement has ranged from 2 to 13. And this shows, this really fits with a pattern of declining successes over the years. When I began with the program in 1992, we were making in the upper 20s, lower 30s number of placements, and it's just steadily declined over time. And I think that this is a clear indication that it takes more and more creative and innovative ways to recruit as time goes on. Another difference from when I first became involved to what our recruiter deals with today is that when I was first involved, it was strictly primary care physicians and nurse practitioners and physician assistants. The need was so great for those three professions that we rarely heard about the need for any other healthcare profession. And so we focused almost exclusively on family medicine physicians and other primary care providers. Now not only are the practice sites telling us that they are in great need of those professions, but also all kinds of healthcare professions, such as radiation technology and health information specialists and specialist physicians that I had not heard about prior to this. So clearly incentives to practice in rural communities are necessary and should be increased in every way possible. I also want to give you a little bit of an idea of how much competition there is for the very small pool of candidates of, let's just take physicians, for example, who are interested in practicing in a rural area. It's really a very small percentage of the folks who graduate after you are in an academic health center for 4 years of medical school and likely another three for your residency training. it's difficult to then relocate back to a rural community, even if you came from one in the first place. So the slice of the pie that's interested in rural practice is fairly small to begin with. Then it's important to remember, and I personally feel that we are not competing with urban sites or with quote-unquote urban candidates and trying to convince them to go to rural. We're working with the pool of candidates who want to go to rural to begin with, and so you're competing with 49 other states to convince them to come to Oregon versus Kentucky or Washington or California. And when you talk about it in those terms, Oregon's practice environment does pose some challenges. For one thing, Medicaid reimbursement is pretty low. Medicare reimbursement rates are among the lowest in the country, particularly in rural Oregon. And of course, the rural Oregon population has a higher percentage of Medicare and Medicaid patients. And so a physician who is going to make a living in a rural community has to rely on that for their patient base, and the source of their income has to rely on that patient mix, I should say. Also, malpractice premium rates are very high, and that's also a factor to consider when they're trying to decide whether or not they can make a living in a rural community. And even those that decide they can make a decent living, given those factors, many of them have really very large debt to deal with all their student loans. What I used to hear, just anecdotally, if I could share, what I used to hear when I was actively recruiting quite often was, you know what, I went into medical school envisioning myself being the family country doc when I finished, and I didn't really even think about anything else than returning to my hometown to be the local physician in the community. And frankly, I could not afford it. And so then I told myself, I'm just going to go to this urban practice here until I get my student loans paid off. Well, you know what? After I got my student loans paid off 10 years later, my kids were in the school system, my spouse had a job, and they were so entrenched in the urban lifestyle that they really found it very difficult to make the shift back. I'm going to move on now quickly to some national statistics, and I wish I had better news, but frankly they predict greater recruitment challenges in the future. The first graph on page 6 illustrates the discrepancy between the rising demand for health care in the United States and the supply of physicians being trained here. The one that has three different color lines, the red line shows the FTE supply of physicians. The line above it, the blue one, is called baseline demand. In other words, if demand remained as exactly as it is today, or increased based on factors that we're experiencing today, that would be the demand compared to the supply. The green line is what's called high growth demand, and I'll just refer back to what Dr. Robertson talked about, the fact that as you age, you require more medical and hospital visits, and so the demand for health care increases as our population ages. There's no reason to believe that the same does not hold true for many other health professions as well, even though physician data and physician projections seem to be easier to locate. I think the same situation is true for many other health professions. One I want to point out in particular that's often overlooked is emergency medical services. Our state is having really quite a difficult time with recruitment and retention of EMTs in rural communities. As I say in my testimony here, we who live in urban areas take 911 and ambulance services for granted, at least until we need them. And frankly, sometimes I have to shake my head and wonder how EMS exists at all in a lot of rural communities, because we are dependent on the goodwill and the sense of duty of the people who live there to volunteer their time to make sure that there is an EMS system at all. I am sometimes truly overwhelmed by the generosity of the people who live in these communities and give so much of themselves to go and be trained and pay for that training out of their pocket, and all the ongoing continuing education that's required. And then, so many times having to work two jobs, they also volunteer to work on the EMS service, and it just goes on and on. So I wanted to point that out in particular. The second graph on page 6 demonstrates that we're currently experiencing a period in which fewer medical students are likely to choose a primary care specialty. Now, this is something that sort of ebbs and flows over the years, but unfortunately, we're at a relatively low point. And, of course, primary care is what's in greatest demand in a rural community. And the final graph, I promise, on top of page 7, is the one that shows the number of physicians, medical students, I should say, choosing family practice training. And I probably don't need to say that family practice is the, as I call it, the bread and butter specialty for rural communities. Every rural community needs family practice. And so this is very disconcerting to see this decline. So what can we do about this multifaceted dilemma here in Oregon? I would never sit in front of you and tell you that I had all the answers, but I do know that the programs Oregon currently has, it's very important to maintain them and to consider adding some others, and I'm talking specifically about incentives to practice in rural Oregon. I'll mention some briefly. One, the state income tax credit for rural providers is very, very important. It was created in 1989. The level of credit is still the same as it was in 1989, so even though now the figure, and it's up to $5,000 worth of state income tax credit, sometimes seems a little outdated. It's still very, very important to the people who live and work in rural communities, and the financial impact is certainly nothing that you would deny, but at the same time, what we hear, again, anecdotally, is that it's equally important that the state has made a demonstrated effort to say we value the fact that you are practicing in our rural communities, and so it's almost the policy position that's as important to the rural providers as the actual dollar credit. And then in 2003, the legislative assembly added rural volunteer EMTs to the tax credit program, but at a maximum benefit of $250 a year. This will be our first year in implementing that particular program, the tax year 2006, so we're just now collecting applications for that. And it looks like there will be thousands of rural volunteer EMTs who will take advantage of that tax credit. The second one I'd like to mention is the medical malpractice reinsurance program. It pays 80% of malpractice premiums for rural obstetricians, 60% of the premiums for rural family practice physicians who do OB, and 40% of the premium for all other physicians. This program sunsets in 2007, and Senate Bill 183 would extend the program for another 4 years or until the funds are depleted, which is estimated to be about 3.5 years. I don't think we can make it quite 4 years if the expenditures are the same as they have been in the first 3 years of this program. Also, the Rural Health Services Loan Repayment Program, again, a program that came into being in 1989, still has the same level of funding, and that's a grand total of $200,000 a year. We're able to award up to $100,000 per eligible candidate, and the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, which actually administers the program, is able to squeeze anywhere from 4 to 7 candidates into that program every year, and that's picking from physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, and pharmacists. Senate Bill 188 would add dentists to the program, a very important addition, and the governor's budget includes an increase in funding for the program of about 150%, going from $200,000 per year to $500,000 per year. I won't talk too much about OHSU's medical school expansion since Dr. Robertson has done that already, but it's very important. I wanted to mention the fact that one of the most exciting things I've heard about since I've begun working at Oregon Health and Science University, and granted I have a fairly narrow view of what happens since my primary interest is in rural Oregon, but there is a program that's being batted around called the Rural Health Scholars Program. Or Rural Scholars Program, and I just want to talk about it a little bit. That is a program where medical school applicants with a rural heritage would be identified. Not only are they from a rural community, but they express from the get-go that they're interested in rural practice. And fine-tuning the curriculum and the program for those particular students to actually train them for rural practice. The skills that are required in a rural setting are somewhat different than practice in an urban area. I would like to tie that to preferential awards with the state loan and payment program, for example, and really try to get that going. Our advisory body, the Rural Health Coordinating Council, has submitted the draft of a bill to legislative council, and we'll just see if that goes anywhere. There is a minor budgetary impact. And then finally, I want to talk about Senate Bill 37. It's also on the House side. It's House Bill 2409, and that's the Rural Health Safety Net Bill. That does three things. It restores funding for rural EMS equipment and training grants. That is money that we had for about 4 years, and it was redirected in the 2003 session. It literally was grants to pay for training and equipment for rural EMS systems. The second thing it does is to provide technical assistance and some operating subsidy for Oregon's smallest and most isolated rural health clinics. Those that if every member of the community went to that clinic for their health care, they still couldn't generate enough revenue to keep the doors open, but it's the only source of health care for quite some distance. And then third, this bill would create a revenue stream for the existing Rural Health Viability Fund that was created, I believe, in the 2001 session but never funded. And that would be that those funds would be used as seed money for aging rural hospitals, for remodeling and building of new facilities. Most of our rural hospitals were built during the 50s and 60s. They're quite outdated, and many need to be replaced. So, with that, I thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions, Representative Flores?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Eklad. I have a couple of questions for you. One in regard to the Rural Scholars Program. You had testified earlier that individuals who might come from a rural background, once they go through medical school and then their residency and become saddled with paying off their loans and what have you, just that period of time away from their rural environment or home setting kind of sets them in a permanent course of I'll remain where I am rather than go back home. So how would the Rural Scholars Program differ with regard to those impediments?
Madam Chair, Representative Flores, that's part of the beauty of the program, and I have to speak, it really, this would all be conjecture since the program doesn't actually exist yet, but should it exist, part of the beauty of the program is that these medical students would do as much of their clinical rotations throughout medical school in a rural community. They'd be matched with a rural physician mentor. I talked about the preferential awarding of the loan repayment, state loan repayment program, so that hopefully the burden of their debt wouldn't be so great, and really trying to chip away at as many of those barriers as possible.
I see. Well, the art is in the detail. One further question, please. Thank you. In regard to the medical malpractice reinsurance program, is this the same piece that probably we heard about in the last number of months, last summer, last spring, whenever it was, that was supposed to be targeted and directed primarily to rural practitioners, and somehow, oops, there are some pretty urban practitioners who are taking advantage of having their malpractice premiums paid by virtue of some fluke of demographic?
Madam Chair, Representative Flores, that is exactly the same program. I'm happy to report that the program is actually being administered exactly the way it's supposed to be, to the letter of the statute. The physicians who practice in Ashland or Newburgh, those are, by definition, rural communities. And the statute also states that all physicians who practice in rural communities can benefit from the program at the 40% subsidy level. I understand that Ashland in particular is a bit of a unique community compared to the communities throughout Oregon, and there are other communities of the same distance from an urban area that we wouldn't have nearly the problem finding out that their physicians were getting malpractice reinsurance. And Ashland's somewhat of a different situation. But I mentioned that there are two bills, actually, one on the House side, one on the Senate side, to look at the program. That bill has language to not only extend the program, but to allow us to change the criteria. And there's a work group that's been formed to make recommendations to the legislature.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Representative Bonamici. My question also was in regards to the medical malpractice reinsurance. I was on the Oregon Health Plan Task Force in the interim, and we had a very interesting hearing where we had some obstetricians and rural health providers call in to talk about the importance of this program to their ability to practice in their communities. And I was wondering, particularly in regards to childbirth services, how this program has helped in terms of the number of women that are able to access prenatal care and access to childbirth services, and what will happen if those funds are depleted at the end of 3.5 years, and what the outlook is for delivery services in particular and also prenatal care.
Vice Chair Bonamici, Representative Gelser, there has been a rather comprehensive survey done actually by colleagues of mine at OHSU, where they not only looked at the data of how the program has been implemented, but also surveyed all the physicians who have participated in the program and asked them both quantitative and qualitative questions. This is just going off the top of my head because I didn't come prepared with the data from that study. But I think on the one hand, the program has not had as much impact on the delivery of obstetrical services as we had once hoped. I think from the qualitative data that was gathered, we found out that it was a little late, that this solution was a little bit late, that once physicians had decided to give up the OB part of their practice, it was much more difficult to pick it back up again. They also asked questions, the people who did the survey also asked questions such as, what would happen when this program goes away? And that is where really the most startling results were gathered, and again, just in generalities, at a minimum, the majority of the respondents said that they would stop doing high-risk procedures, and that goes all the way from obstetrics to trauma care, frankly. And many also said that they would have to seriously consider giving up practice not only in rural Oregon, but in Oregon.
A follow-up? Yes. In the rural areas, and I know that the obstetrics gets that 80% subsidy, you had talked earlier about family practice being the bread and butter of rural health care. What is the likely? I know that across the state, more and more family practitioners are eliminating delivery services as part of their practice due to malpractice premiums. Is that the same in rural areas? Are family practitioners still delivering babies in the rural parts of the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, I think, and again, this is just anecdotal, but I believe that fewer family practice physicians in rural Oregon are providing OB services.
Thank you. And may I please have one more question on one other topic? I'm wondering about the demographic of the doctors in the rural area in terms of age and how many might be close to retirement, and whether or not the stability of the limited number of physicians we have out there, what that looks like in the long run. Are we facing a retirement crisis?
Yes, if you look at the age bubble if you were to look at a graph that shows the age, the physicians in rural Oregon are slightly older, and so I think that problem is a little more immediate for rural communities even than for urban. Thankfully, I think many rural physicians tend to work for a longer period of time or until a later age than many urban, and many feel a responsibility not to retire or give up their practices until a replacement has been found, just out of a sense of duty to their patients.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your testimony. Before I let you go, I'm going to ask Representative Broome, did you have a question?
No, I'm good.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Cheryl Gebhardt from the Hospital and Health Systems Association.
And Madam Chair, while they're coming forward to the table, I'd like to pass out to you some written testimony from Glenn Cunningham, who is a nurse at the Silverton Hospital, He wanted to come and speak, but he's submitting this written testimony for the record.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Bonamici, members of the House Healthcare Subcommittee. I'm Cheryl Gephardt, and I'm the Director of Human Resources I'm at Valley Medical Center. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Healthcare Systems. And as a board member and president of the Human Resources arm of the OHHS, I'm here to share some concerns with you about healthcare workforce shortage from the perspective of a rural hospital, and that's Willamette Valley Medical Center. Just to give you a little background on Willamette Valley Medical Center, it's located in McMinnville, and it's licensed for 80 beds. However, we have 65 beds in service. Last year, we started an expansion project to the tune of $24 million that will increase our bed capacity by 28 inpatient beds. Included in that is an additional three ICU beds, plus eight new emergency rooms, expanding our lab services, our pharmacy and imaging services. We also opened a wound care center in August of 2006 with hyperbaric treatments for difficult-to-heal wounds. We are the sole community provider, and our total service population is approximately 52,000 people, and this includes people from McMinnville, Dayton, Amity, Sheridan, Willamette. Willamette Valley Medical Center is a level 3 trauma center. It provides a number of services from primary to specialty care. We employ 540 employees. Seven of those are hospitalists, and 28 are physicians and their 28 physicians plus their clinic staff. We are probably the second largest employer in McMinnville. So we do contribute not only income, but we pay state and federal taxes as well.
Madam Chair, may I just have clarification on a term? Thank you. Hospitalist.
Hospitalist is a physician and internist that practices primarily or solely within the hospital. So if a patient is admitted to the hospital, they're under the care of a hospitalist or an internist. Their family practice physician or their physician that they see outside of the facility is kept up to date on their status, but the management of the care is primarily by the hospitalist.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Key workforce issues, and I think you have my testimony there. We are 20 minutes away from Providence Newburgh. We are about 30 minutes away from the Salem Hospital and about 50 miles from Lincoln City. That encompasses basically our immediate competitive market. The shortages we experience at Willamette Valley Medical Center include many of those that are typical across the state. I think by far imaging, all of the imaging physicians, particularly CT or CAT scan technologists, it takes 3 or 4 months to actually get a hire in that position. Mammographers currently are so difficult to find. We've had an opening since September of 06. Currently, we're filling it with travelers to the tune of $60 to $70 an hour. In any open position, we're paying current staff overtime, which is time and a half, and it can be double time on holidays and when there is a particular little pinch that we just can't find anyone at all. And then the expense of recruiters in order to find hard-to-fill positions can be paid from 25 to 30% of the first annual salary. So as you can see, these vacancies do cause a great deal of economic damage to the hospital. Nursing, over the past 2 years, 40% of our newly hired RNs are new graduates. And we are very thankful for our relationship with Chemeketa Community College and the other community colleges in ensuring that we do have new graduate nurses. However, it is difficult to fill the specialty positions, such as the OR nurse, ICU, and ER nurses. We lost 4 full-time nurses to a neighboring facility who offered 10 to 15,000 sign-on bonuses. And we couldn't compete with that. I mean, we were ready to give all of our nurses $10,000 to $15,000 to stay. It just was something we felt rather helpless to do anything about. Nurse practitioners takes up to 4 months to fill that position. Respiratory therapists are becoming increasingly difficult to find as well, and take a number of months to fill that position. Physical therapy, last year it took over a year to fill the physical therapy position. In addition to those that I've mentioned, medical lab technologists, polysomnographers or sleep techs, coders, transcriptionists, medical assistants, as you can see, it's kind of the broad stroke of all healthcare positions that sometimes can be very difficult to fill. The effects of this shortage on our facility, as I talked about earlier, on the sign-on bonuses, there are wage wars going on. There are a number of different perspectives or perks that people provide. To be competitive, you want to get the splash in the newspaper, on the website, many times dangling money, relocation, sign-on bonuses are expected. But there's simply a supply and demand issue. And even though you recruit and hire today, you know that you're going to have another position to fill tomorrow. So it's something that is a problem not only in our hospital. When I talk to other human resources directors, they're having the same issue. And it's sad that we're competing for the same workforce. Obviously, we all recruit, or we try to recruit nationwide, and sometimes we recruit foreign nurses, but we at Willamette Valley found that that did not work. The foreign nurses that we hired, it took 2 years to get to our facility and start working, and then within a year, that nurse was, in spite of an employment agreement, was lured away by a $10,000 to $15,000 sign-on bonus. So that was zero in terms of return on investment. We also have an increased challenge to meet the needs of our community. Fluctuations in patient census. If a physician goes on vacation and does not have days in surgery like we staff to, typically we ask people to stay home. They can choose to take a vacation day for pay, or they can choose to not take pay. But that causes difficulty in recruitment and retention. Now, during the summer months in a rural setting, a rural hospital, perhaps more than one physician will go on vacation. And if they happen to be a surgeon, that is quite traumatic to the OR staff. And I think that did contribute to the loss of two RNs over the last year. We also have difficulty filling positions that are vacated by family medical leave, workers' comp injuries, sick calls. Because we're so small, because people generally don't hire on in on-call positions, and if they are, they're really not as available as you like them to be, we have difficulty meeting the needs of our community at times. And over the last year, I think we've gone on divert more than 3 times. That means that we had to divert patients that come through the emergency room to other facilities. And that is something that we prefer not to do. Our community members have a hospital that they would like to stay in their community and be served there, as opposed to going to another facility. Root causes, in my opinion, there's barriers to entry into the professions. There's a lack of qualified program faculty in our schools to meet the growing need for professional healthcare workers. Their pay is not competitive at market rates. A bachelor's prepared nurse or a master's prepared nurse can make up to $40 an hour. If they are paid at a school, it is considerably lower. It could be as much as 2/3 of that pay. And most individuals are not willing to make that sacrifice. plus the need for bachelor's or master's prepared faculty is a problem because there are so few of them that are actually master's and bachelor's prepared. The majority of the nurses that we see are two-year associate's degree nurses, and they need for clinical and for theory at the schools, they need a bachelor's or a master's. And due to the few slots that are available in these programs or a total lack of the programs, it seems that the admission requirements are more and more stringent. Grade point average has to be higher, and still, if you have very good grades, it may be difficult to get in at all. Also, as Mr. Goldberg mentioned, the aging of our workforce. Our average age of the nurse is 47. And 64% of our employees are over 40. 36% are over 50. Our workers are approaching retirement years. Healthcare can be taxing on the body. If you're a med-surg nurse and you've lifted many heavy patients over your tenure, it does wear down the body, and many of the nurses would prefer to either decrease the number of hours they work or retire. Of course, that's matched up with the increasing age of our nation as a whole, as you mentioned. In addition to that, another issue is legislative mandates. We have increasing reporting requirements, whether it's HIPAA, staffing ratios, increased documentation requirements from certifying bodies such as Joint Commission, increasingly complex technology. We have found that we need more people in order to get the job done. I think I heard an emergency room nurse say that for every patient they see in the emergency room, it takes almost an hour to document that visit. That means, I mean, there is such an immense amount of documentation that has to occur that nurses and all healthcare workers have a great responsibility to document, and that is taking more and more time. It just takes more staff to run a hospital nowadays. So what we're doing about many of these issues, internally, I'll speak to that first, is we have a tuition reimbursement program for people that would like to go into a nursing profession or other profession. We have an academic reimbursement program for those nurses that would like to obtain their BSN or MSN. We have a volunteer guild program that's a scholarship fund for employees. We give bonuses to those nurses who obtain national certification, like critical care registered nurses, their certification, emergency room nurses, that we feel improves patient care, and it's a retention strategy as well. Mm-hmm. We provide a housing allowance in addition to relocation. This is part of our recruitment package. We found that many people coming from other parts of the United States have a little sticker shock when they see the prices in McMinnville for houses. So we have a relocate or housing allowance that we give to them. It could be $5,000 to $10,000 plus 1% of the mortgage, because we feel that that is a retention strategy. If you have a house to sell, you might reconsider moving right away. So that is one of the things we use. We promote from within at most opportunities, because we believe that that is also a retention strategy. And we use clinical ladders. We have a night shift loan reimbursement program. We have a shared governance model that gives staff, nurses, a voice. Staffing committees that get staff involved in developing staffing structure and decisions. So those things that make for a quality work setting are the things that we're working on for retention. And at this point at Willamette Valley Medical Center, our employee satisfaction scores are at 94%. And that's very good. But still, we struggle to fill our open positions. We also contribute dollars to support a faculty position for a nursing instructor at Chemeketa Community College. We also supply scholarships through their foundation. We provide clinical rotation sites for Linfield and Chemeketa nursing programs. And one of the more, my favorite program that we have used in the past is in 2005, we partnered with the Oregon Health Career Center, Oregon Hospital, Salem Hospital, and the Office of Minority Health, and developed the N2K program for nursing students. And I know that Kaiser is participating in that with, I believe, Lane Community College currently, but ours was specific to incumbent workers who are bilingual and bicultural. So we interviewed some of our current employees that were interested in the nursing program. We found two excellent candidates, and they went through a very intensive prerequisite for nursing curriculum, and then through the nursing program were plugged into, in addition to the current Chemeketa Community College program. And we are happy to say that a number of those individuals did graduate and have their nursing license today, and our two individuals, of course, did, and they are doing quite well. One is functioning as an intensive care nurse now, and the other is a med-surg nurse. So we were very pleased with that partnership. There were federal grants, state grants, and workforce investment grants that were involved in that. We also, like many facilities, organizations, we partner with our high schools to provide clinical experience for their health occupations classes. We participate in the Healthcare Advisory Committee, Oregon Center for Nursing, Oregon State Board of Nursing Task Force to address Nurse Practice Act issues. We participate in the OAHHS Hospital 2800 Task Force. We're looking for opportunities to be involved because we want some answers. So what can leaders like yourself do about this? One of the things, and I talked with Gary Wappas, who is the president for Oregon Health Career Center, he and I talked about perhaps relaxing the workforce investment dollars. They're currently restricted as to what they can pay for, how long the programs are. As an example, you must show results in less than a year, when most of these professional programs are, of course, beyond a year. They're more than a year. You make the application process simpler for employees, perhaps they would more readily make those funds available to them. I'd like to see funding to higher education to expand more technical programs and, of course, adjust wages for the faculty of those programs to at least meet market wages. I'd like to incentivize higher education programs with grant dollars that promote progressive ways to educate professions similar to the N2K program. I think that's a great template. It's worked well. It worked well for us. I'd like to see more of that. Also create financial incentives for employees in smaller communities, whether it's tax incentives, savings, loan assistance, or housing assistance. These are people that primarily need to meet the needs of their family in terms of economics. In other words, they must work and go to school. So some sort of creative answer to or approach to providing education for them that may be off-site, may be virtual, but something that will increase the number of people that are available and interested in healthcare. Also, just plain awareness of healthcare opportunities. I know that I take every opportunity I can to talk to high school kids and students and tell them what a great profession nursing is, because I started in healthcare as a nurse and still maintain my license, and I've been able to just do many things, and I've always had a job. It's very easy to find a job no matter where I go. But letting these kids know that healthcare is an exciting field and they get paid well for doing it. And I've found that they respond quite nicely to that. And whether it's a health fair, whether it's they want to know what everyone makes. And so we tell them. So I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm willing to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Are there any questions for Ms. Gephardt? Questions? Thank you so much for being here. Well, I think you answered them all in comprehensive testimony. Thank you so much. Next we have Scott, is it Gallant?
Yes, ma'am.
Oregon Medical Association. Thank you.
A man as old as this building.
For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm the Associate Executive Director of the Oregon Medical Association. You can call me anything. I'll still come up to the mic. I've done this once or twice. I'll actually summarize my comments. You have my written comments before you, but there were a couple. I think there were a couple very important points made by a number of people, and I'm going to try to tie those together. But my underlying theme is there are a large number of organizations that are looking at healthcare and particularly physician workforce issues, and they are not very well coordinated. Secondly, there is not a real-time database that can actually tell you what kind of practice a physician has, whether they're working part-time, time-sharing, whether even if you know someone is in general practice or, let's say, internal medicine, it doesn't tell you whether or not they have actually have a subspecialty in something else. It is exceedingly critical, and this legislative body could do the state a very huge favor by finding some resources to assist us, the Medical Association, the Office of Health Policy, for example, the Institute, OHSU, Hospital Association, the BME, and others, in having a real-time database for physicians in order to have a real idea of what's happening in the state, because no one truly knows. And we have done, the Medical Association, either on our own and or in conjunction with many of these same players, a number of surveys that provide pretty good data, but it's still not comprehensive enough nor usable enough, and it's very expensive to do. But I think everyone wants to do that. Secondly, we have a major problem in Oregon on the age of physicians. You will find in my testimony some information about physicians, what physicians plan to do for retirement. The numbers are scary. It's particularly acute in rural Oregon, but it is not limited to rural Oregon. Our trauma system used to be one of the best in the country, most innovative. It is in disarray. We are in divert in Portland almost every day. And there's one other point that I think you're beginning to pick up. Physicians, nurses, and others practice in a national, international market. And if the view nationally is that the environment in which one might have in Oregon is worse than Texas, Florida, Ohio, France, or anywhere else, they can go there and practice, and it's becoming more difficult to recruit and retain physicians in this state because we are not competitive. It is an exceedingly difficult market today because of reimbursement, liability and environment. 30% of the healthcare premium dollars for overhead. It's a waste. Physicians' overhead costs easily range, depending on what kind of practice you have, from 60% to 70% or worse, just to cover the cost of the practice, of their practices. From everything from what it costs to hire competent people, to do programming, and all the things that everybody wants to require us all to do. But it costs a tremendous amount of money, and in a lot of instances, the expertise is not available. The Rural Liability Subsidy Program is critical. There's shortages in everything you can think of. family practice, internal medicine, general surgery, gastroenterology. You can go down the list. It is huge. The program that Dr. Robertson mentioned about retraining physicians who want to get back in the program, the OMA has begun some initial, very preliminary, quiet discussions with Central Wyden staff about whether we can try to gather some resources to help do that. A physician, former president of the OMA, who now works for the OMA in a program that we have, actually came up with this concept and began talking to OHSU about this. It is a wonderful concept and something that should be supported. Anyway, I volunteer the association and our lobbyists, who are not here, who left me in the lurch, to help you in every way we can. I do understand there's some criticism of the Rural Liability Subsidy Program, but I can assure you that if you don't have general surgeons, if you don't have the few specialists who can provide services in rural Oregon, it will be a loss for all of us. And it's a very insignificant portion of the use of those funds in spite of what has been published in paper. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. You certainly did emphasize the seriousness of the issue. Are there some questions? Representative Gelser?
Thank you, Representative Bonamici. I actually had a comment on the rural reinsurance for doctors. I came to that, I mentioned before we had a hearing on this in the interim, and I came to that meeting very skeptical, having just read the article about the situation in Ashland, and came away with a very different understanding of the program after we had the opportunity to really hear from the majority of physicians that were impacted by this and looking at their expenses, particularly for those specialty surgeons and obstetricians, looking at what it would do to their practice if they didn't. And that survey was brought, what would happen if this was no longer there, and the number of those physicians that would go out of practice and pull their shingle off the wall if they didn't have that incentive to be able to stay was pretty alarming when we already have a workforce issue in our rural areas.
Well, thank you for that observation.
And, Madam Chair, might I just add, I was in no way meaning to be critical of the program. I think it's very good, very valuable to be serving the needs of those people, those practitioners in rural areas, and that we make sure that it's meeting the needs of the practitioners in the rural areas.
Yeah. And we agree wholeheartedly.
Representative Brown?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott, your point about Oregon not being very competitive when it comes to, you know, attracting, if you will, outside of Oregon, doctors and medical staff is an excellent point. Nevertheless, is there any sort of I don't know where it would come from, honestly, maybe your organization, but is there any organized effort that you're aware of in the state that is actively recruiting outside of Oregon?
There are institutions, the Office of Rural Health, private practices, they all try to recruit, and they're doing exactly what you just heard. In order to convince young physicians to come to Oregon, they're having to provide bonuses and incentives to enhance them here, and it's becoming more and more difficult. Just Salem has had incredible difficulty, and I don't know that they have yet, to recruit general surgeons to this city. And you're seeing it everywhere.
But can I follow up? How does the Salem Hospital do that, though? I mean, are they doing nationwide searches?
They all do. I'm sorry. I'm sure I'm... I know I'm not doing the protocol. I never liked it, but so I ignore it.
I'm sorry.
But yes, of course they do, and there are companies who do those searches. But again, if you look at the demographics, which you've already heard about, it takes 10 to 14 years for a physician to go through that whole process. And I mean, just think about it. When we have numbers, at least our data is showing 20 to 22% of the physicians in Oregon are talking about retiring in the next 5 years. That's a huge number, particularly when it's my view that you only have approximately 8,200 to 8,400 or maybe a little more clinically practicing physicians in this state. Okay? And they are not taking Medicare patients. They're not taking more new Medicaid patients. How do you sell that when everyone is expecting, you know, the irony of the debate about universal coverage? You may have universal coverage, but I don't know where they're going to go. I'm serious. It is a real dilemma. And we all support that, I'm sure. But it's not just increasing coverage. It's making sure you actually have the capacity to provide the service that individuals deserve. 18,000 Americans die a year because they don't have health insurance, according to one study. That's obscene, for God's sake. But we do have to think about what we're demanding everyone in the healthcare arena to do and what our expectations are. Anyway, that's my plea. Good information would be wonderful. I'm very serious about that. That's just a fundamental building block. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Before I let you go, were you in the room when Representative Greenlick asked his question to David Goldberg? Because Representative Greenlick indicated that he was going to ask the two Scots. Now, there's a lot of Scots in this room.
Well, he was looking
at Scots per capita is pretty high right now. Right. But because Representative Greenlick needed to leave, I'm going to take this opportunity to ask you, and I'm sorry I forgot to ask Mr. Ekblad this question, but if you could respond to Representative Greenlick's concerns,
I'm sure I would be much more comfortable in responding to it than Mr. Ekblad, unless he wants to come forward, and I doubt if he does. My note on Representative Greenlick's observation is food fights. I've been in this business for a very, very long time, and I have heard the same descriptions about what someone's scope of practice and capabilities are. It is irrational. They are typically fictional, and they are a direct result of political and legislative decisions that this body and others around the country choose to make in many instances. The real issue for me is, in a more serious note, whether the services being provided are actually appropriate, effective, and produce the result that you're really looking for. And I think that's the key issue. I mean, you can go, 70% of healthcare dollars are spent on chronic care. Huge number. And we have no system that truly enables individuals who want to stay home with very serious illnesses to be able to do so, because if you've had experiences with parents or other loved ones in these circumstances, there are very serious medical problems that require very sophisticated services that are very difficult to provide in the home because you need technical and medical assistance in that process that is typically beyond the average spouse's or relative's ability to provide. It's very, very expensive. So with that easy response, it's an issue. This is an issue that has been floating and discussed. See, I started with OMA in 1979. This is not new news, I'm sorry to say.
Thank you, Mr. Glanton. I saw Mr. Ekblad move forward, and I take that as an indication of his desire to respond to Representative Greenlick's concerns as well.
Madam Chair, I'd like to take Mr. Gallant's challenge.
Appreciate that. I'm sure Representative Greenlick will appreciate that as well.
I did have a thought when he brought up that question, and frankly, I think that rural healthcare environments are great demonstration project, have great demonstration project potential. And so, for example, other folks from statewide agencies with an interest in health and health policy have discussed a couple different models that are strictly that in a discussion stage right now. But, for example, one of the reasons it's so difficult to retain someone who goes through EMS training to the point where they're a paramedic, there just aren't that many employment opportunities for a paramedic in a rural community. So once they get paramedic training, if they choose that as their profession, then they have to move to an urban area in order to find employment. So what about the model of, let's say, a community health paramedic, where they also did some other sort of basic preventive public health sort of practice? There's a model where that's done in Alaska. There's a model where that's being done in New Mexico. Rural communities where the providers all know one another and, generally speaking, get along, if they can agree to something like that, that's a great, I think, opportunity for a demonstration project. I was approached by a pharmacist who's approaching retirement. We haven't even talked about the retirement age of pharmacists here today, but believe me, that's another problem that we'll be talking about a lot in the near future. And he said, you know, it was also discussed that the pharmacists that are coming out of school now are at the doctorate level, and so they're very well trained. He said, frankly, they are a lot smarter, a lot more skilled, a lot more knowledgeable than I am, and it's a waste for them to be simply counting pills all day long like I do, he said. Why don't, and this is just throwing out a wild idea, especially with the OMA in the room, but why don't the pharmacists with this level of training, why don't they do the prescribing part of the patient visit and free up the physician when physicians are facing such pressures for performance? For example, you know, see a patient every 10 minutes, et cetera, et cetera. These, you know, the pharmacists are the pharmacological experts. So those kinds of ideas do float around, and I think that, again, rural communities are great demonstration projects, opportunities.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Ekblad? He's returned. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I think part of the reason for this subcommittee on health policy is to entertain creative, innovative ideas like that. So I certainly appreciate that. And unless there is an objection, I hereby adjourn the House Committee on Healthcare Subcommittee on Health Policy.